accession number 20456, reel 3.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 3. You're saying you came back from the tank school, qualified in driving, and presumably also qualified to teach driving.
Never be a driving instructor.
Really? What are the perils of being a driving instructor?
Well, it's how far you can let your pupil sort of go without sort of giving a shriek of horror or interfering. Because if you do that, he loses confidence and so on. It is a question of trust, you know. Am I good enough to, you know, make sure that this guy can take charge?
How did you get on? Did the jocks take to driving?
Oh, marvellous. No problem. No problem whatsoever.
How long did it take normally to teach a soldier to drive competently so you could leave him to drive on his own without supervision?
I would say 6 weeks. And that allows for cross country. But those were 1500 weight, 1300 weight trucks. More complicated things, that's all different. But then I wasn't dealing with them.
What was the 1500 weight truck like to drive? Did it have synchro mesh and other?
1500 weight truck, I could again show you the pictures of the ones we had. They were converted Chevrolet trucks. Converted in Bombay, lovely, lovely trucks. Didn't look anything like the British 1500 weight, and in many ways were better.
In what ways were they better then?
Better engine. I don't know. They were very, very, very good trucks.
Were they reliable? Did they keep going under?
Oh, yes. Yes, the big, big lesson is never, never, never let soldiers open the bonnet and start fiddling in the inside. Like the Bren carrier. The Bren carrier would go for thousands of miles providing you didn't start fiddling with it. Providing you kept the petrol and oil clean and, you know, greased the various points, it gave you no trouble.
I was going to ask you about what sort of routine maintenance tasks had to be carried
out. Oh, well, they were very strictly laid down.
There.
Yeah.
Were they done on a daily basis or a weekly
basis?
Well,
you had a daily stuff, weekly stuff, and every month every vehicle was inspected. And you had an inspection form that the transport officer or transport sergeant had to go over and sign. So, and that was with the actual vehicle's logbook.
Who actually dealt with repairs and more complicated tasks?
We were very lucky. We had a detachment from the tank corps who stayed with us for 6 months and trained up our fitters and people.
So you had your own fitters eventually?
Yes.
It sounds like an organic LAD.
Entirely.
How did you choose the soldiers who were going to be trained for those more specialist tasks? Did you just pick them out? Or
we had so many. You see, we started becoming specialists. Signalers, terribly important. Cooks, terribly important. And then you got down to your drivers and driver mechanics and people. I don't know, in those days, now it came in later, you had this business of regulating soldiers from A, the top, to D, and you had the whole business of C plus and C minus. It was the C minuses you were always short of, because they were the jolly good chap who could jolly nearly do anything. And your A's were rarely sort of intelligence corps, God knows what. Your B's were leaders and officers. C plus were junior leaders. But C minus were the rails of none of the battalion. Below that, you got people who weren't all that. They were all right under supervision, but they weren't all that good. That was introduced during the war.
Is this a case of grading them then?
Well, you had selection grading. You see, we didn't have selection grading in those days. You had to play it as it went along, as it were.
Did any of your soldiers have civilian experience which was applicable? Had any of them worked in?
Oh, very much so. Yes, they had. A lot of them had worked. You name it, railwaymen, all sorts of things.
Because Glasgow was a major industrial centre, wasn't it? So one would expect.
Well, yes, indeed. Yes.
They would have
yes.
the sort
correct.
Of experience
correct.
They could use.
Absolutely correct.
So you'd done the tank schools, and then you were training the battalion up to be a machine gun battalion and to be motorised. This must have had a considerable impact on normal training, on normal infantry training.
Well, when you say normal training, it was normal training. That was our training programme. We were machine gunners, but not for long, because then suddenly. And this was 1938, middle of 38. The whole thing changed. If you remember, there was a Munich Agreement in 38. And from then on, people started thinking about Germany very seriously indeed, and thinking about war very seriously indeed. And we were 12 Brigade, which was part of 4th Indian Division, and we were originally destined to go to the Middle East.
4th Indian Division did, didn't it?
Of course it did, yes. But yes. Only two brigades went initially. The 12th Brigade went to Malaya. Mm. And at the same time, we got posted to us a very interesting character called Ian Stewart. And Ian Stewart was a senior Argyle. He'd had an incredible career. He'd been very badly shot up in 1914. So much so that he was told that he should not on any account serve in infantry again. So being Ian Stewart, he joins a tank corps and he leads the first tank attack on foot. I said, no tank? And he said, well, they were useless. He said, you couldn't hear, you couldn't see, you couldn't know wireless. And he said, the only way you could deal with them was go in front and, you know, it's the point of the stick at where you want them to do next. And I said, but that must be pretty dangerous. And he said, no, it wasn't. The Germans had all run away. he then passed brilliantly into the Staff College in the 1920s and refused to go because he didn't agree with the system.
Why didn't he agree with the system?
Well, he loathed, like my father, the average regimental officer in World War I had no, what you might call, opinion of staff officers whatsoever. And even later, to be a staff officer was about as low as you could get. Anyway, out he came, and he got hold of us, his second battalion. And he said, look, he said, we will be at war within a year. And he said, as a battalion, you are useless, you know. You're not trained for one thing, you're not trained for another.
Do you think those criticisms were fair and reasonable?
Oh, yes, they were very fair. They were very fair. I mean, we could drive, we could do all sorts of things, we could shoot straight. But, I mean, as a battalion, we had no idea of working together. We were far too taken up in individual training to train people for new jobs.
So you hadn't done any collective tactical training?
Exactly. By which time it was known that we were going to Singapore, or Malaysia, really. And so he said, we will now start learning about what war is and how we are going to fight the Japanese, because no one has the slightest idea of how to fight the Japanese.
How much warning did you have that you were going off to Malaya?
We knew after that business of Chamberlain, you remember?
After Munich business?
Yes, after Munich.
But at that time, Japan was not yet
No.
French enemy.
Japan was in no way. Japan was, except there were one or two little shipping incidents where things hadn't gone quite right. Anyway, the first thing he said was, we are totally short of what I call really good NCOs.
But was he Ian Stuart then the battalion commander?
No, he was second command.
Second command?
He was second command.
Yeah.
And he said, the average training of our NCOs is all wrong. He said, I am going to take 30 selected NCOs, which he had the commanding officers approval for, and train them into platoon commanders, because that is going to be their job in war. And so he started the first of these NCOs cadres, and we'd won about four before we went to Singapore in 1939.
You had 120 NCOs who'd been trained.
Yes, but an awful lot. Unfortunately, by which time the home territorial army was expanding like nobody's business, and we were being asked to send some of our very best soldiers back home.
The drafts were going in the opposite direction.
Yes, you see, so that one had a constant drain of trained NCOs, and these were good NCOs, back home.
What did he actually do with them when he took them on the training, on the cadre courses? What sort of...
Well, it was a mixture of... could you put your hand behind that light there? There's one on the table. Right behind the actual light fitting. Sorry. Well, first of all, he said that you're no good unless you... are better with your weapon than the guys you're leading, you know.
So it's basic weapon training.
Basic weapon
training.
One
item, yes.
And then he said, right, you've also got to realise that leading men is not just a question of standing out on the parade ground and shouting out orders at them. It is, you know, being put into odd positions, you know, getting out of it on your own steam and taking your own decisions. And so his cadres were a mixture of weapon training, basically leadership. That's all about.
Was most of the work done out in the field on tactical?
Oh, I mean, we used to be sent off into Indian villages in the sort of jungle and told to sort of exist, you know, with you had your iron rations only, and you were given rendezvous points to get to. It's sort of like the Chindit training, basically. And so you had, by the end of it, some pretty knowledgeable NCOs.
This sounds like what they would call survival training today.
Yes, very much so, except that the leadership came in, because in the evenings they would be talked to about the political situation, the way the army was deploying, the influence of sea power, you know, so that by the end of that cadre, he'd built up a reservoir of people who saw a little bit further than the barrack square.
Did the men selected for this course welcome that?
Oh, yes.
Education?
Oh, my goodness me, yes. Oh, yes. Well, you see, he said, Ian had said for a long time, that we, the British Army, were over-officered, and basically speaking, our selection of officers wasn't all that good. Your best people before the war were going into industry and all the rest of it. they weren't necessarily going into the regular army. There were all sorts of other things. And so the regular army, although it had in many ways a very good army, it had a high opinion of itself. The people who it used as officers to fight in the desert and in Italy and in Bella were a very different crowd that were around in 1939.
Isn't that something that happens at the beginning of every war, that there's a grand sorting out on first encounter with the
absolutely
enemy?
True.
And lots of people who are perfectly good trainers get sent home, and competent commanders seem to emerge by natural selection.
Correct. Correct. And the other thing was that he said that, basically speaking, our command structure was too old, that to command a battalion when you were over 30 was almost asking too much in proper wartime, and to be a company commander over 25 again, you were pushing it.
How old were you at that time? You were coming up for
mid-20s. I was coming up 25, 26, you see. Yeah.
What, were you a company commander by that time?
I was, though. I had two jobs. I was basically in charge of the MTE, and I was also training up the carrier platoon.
Did you actually go on these courses with him? Did you
take yes. Part in this? Yes. Well, we acted as instructors.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we did.
It sounds as though he had exceptional foresight if he was looking ahead.
Oh, yeah. Quite exceptional.
Fighting the Japanese.
Quite exceptional.
Do you remember what he said about the way in which the Japanese were likely to conduct themselves on operations?
Oh, yes. I have it all down the hill. He read them completely. He said what we didn't know was how they would defend themselves. So the defensive bunkers was something that we learned the hard way when it came to the crunch in 1942-43. But as far as the attacking was concerned, he said they will come at you very light, they'll fix you in the front, and then they will encircle you. Because in those days, the only way we had of getting supplies up to people were up roads and tracks. There were no parachutes, nothing like that. And so, therefore, if your supply line was cut, your whole plan of defence, you know, was up the spout.
Sounds very much like an 18th century manoeuvre.
Yes, it was.
The manoeuvre on the line of supply.
That's it. That's it.
Where had he got his knowledge of the Japanese tactics and style?
He had been in Shanghai in the 1920s and 30s, where he picked it up, I don't know, but he was one of these brilliant guys who pick up anything, you know. He was just a brilliant leader of men.
The Japanese were present in Shanghai, weren't they, at that time?
Oh, yes, and they had a
considerable
whole brigade, I think, in Shanghai, yes. Oh. Yes, they did.
So he was intent on informing the whole battalion of the way in which they would...
Yes, I may say he had the full support of our brigade commander, Archie Paris, and we had two Indian battalions as well, and they were also sort of imbued with the same doctrine.
Do you remember which battalions they were?
Yes, 4th 19th Hyderabad, and 5th, 2nd Punjabis.
Did you have much to do with them?
At games, yes. In training, yes. Not really. They were in a different part of the cantonment, you see, you know. One didn't see all that much of them, no.
What was their standard of training like?
Their what?
Their standard of training.
Oh, by the time we got to Singapore, good. They were well trained.
Were they trained in the same style of tactics as...
We were?
You were.
Yes, we were.
So the brigade consisted of the three battalions. Did you have any brigade troops?
Well, we had a a fuel company of Madras Saddles and Miners, and with us, so we never saw them, was a mountain regiment who went to Saint Malo. I don't think we ever cooperated with them in the war. I don't remember.
So they're only nominally part of the brigade?
No.
Do you think you were well prepared when you went on to Malaya?
No. I think we were quite well prepared mentally. I think that when it came to arms, dreadful. I mean, dear me. We had no wireless. Brigade, there was a rally back to brigade, number one said.
So this was a battalion wireless set?
No. I never saw my first battalion wireless set till 1942.
So how did you get back to brigade? Was
it you had the number one set.
Yes.
Plus cable.
Yes.
That's what you were, or civilian. We didn't have proper anti-tank guns. We didn't have 3-inch mortars. We didn't have our full complement of Bren carriers. A lot of things we didn't have, yeah.
What about the basic weapons, so that the Lee Enfield rifle, the Bren gun, were they effective weapons?
Oh, yes. We had all those, no problem there. Yes, no. We had absolutely no problem with them at all.
What about anti-aircraft? Was there anything?
Well, you had, if you remember, the Bren tripod sort of extended itself and produced a sort of anti-aircraft. We came across the first anti-aircraft guns in 1939-40 in Singapore. There weren't any in India that I knew of.
How did you get to Singapore?
From Madras in a converted British India boat called the Egra, which was converted into a troop ship. It was about 5,000-ton ship, fast sort of Bear Bengal mail liner.
Was that a comfortable transfer?
Not really, no. Adequate. It was all right for the officers. Bloody awful for the troops.
What happened to you when you got to Singapore?
We were.
Was this before or after the outbreak of war?
No. This was. We left Secunda Bell, I think, on about the 4th or 5th of August, 1939.
So this is before the outbreak.
Yes. 4th Division deployed, mobilised and deployed before then. We were in Singapore when wars occurred. Well, we personally were sent to share barracks with the first Loyals, Gilman Barracks, W Barracks. But our rail was never Singapore Island. Our rail was always the mainland. And the first bit of our rail was the fence of the road down from Mersing, from Indau. And so hardly been, we've been about Singapore a month to sort of get ourselves organized, and up we went to Mersing, and there we stayed there for some time. We always kept a company at Mersing. Mersing is on the seaside. It was a lovely beach for Japanese land if they wanted to. But they built us a special camp out of Attap and a place called Tarsal Park. Which is now the Botanical Garden of Singapore. And that held ourselves, 12 Brigade Headquarters, the 4th 19th Hyderabads, and the Sappers.
Very substantial.
Yes. But that was purely a base on the island. It was not our operational, you know. We were never intended to fight from it.
Did the actual outbreak of war come as a surprise?
No. Not at all. Well, there had been all sorts of goings on or Hong Kong with Japanese merchant ships and cruisers and things. And the Japanese were beginning to get very, very stroppy.
Did you ever think that there might be an internal security threat in Singapore?
Yes. And what is more, we were fully briefed and trained for that by the Malay police.
What sort of training had you done? What sort of...
Well, basically, it was Northern Intelligence Corps stuff. It was basically anti-Chinese. They were the people who they thought would give them extra trouble. Of course, the Chinese were highly organized in that sort of cells and things. They were very well.
Who was thought to be in control of the Chinese community who might want them to become troublesome?
Don't think anyone really knew. There was a terrible rift between the civilian government and how can I put it? The military. In fact, Louis Allen has written a very good book about it. Information down to us came down rather slowly, as it were.
You mentioned the Malayan police. How did you get on with them?
Oh, very well. They were, a lot of them, come the war, joined us and fought with us. They're very good.
I mean, presumably they had an intelligence system or something.
Oh, yes, yes.
Find out what was going on.
But that did not come down our way.
It didn't?
No.
There was no horizontal contact between you?
There may have been a higher level than brigade, but... I'm sure it was a brigade, but battalion-wise, no, wouldn't go much.
Would the sort of operations you would have conducted in Singapore have been the same as those you would have conducted in India, the street securing and clearing procedures, riot drills?
Yes, exactly.
Had you ever had occasion to use that sort of drill in India itself?
No, thank heavens, I had not.
What was the political atmosphere like in India at that time, just before and just after the, round about the time of the
Well,
war?
Well, difficult to say. You see, we were in a native state. Yes. That is a, the Nizam Hyderabad state. Place bigger than France, with a very strange relationship between the Viceroy and the Nizam, who was an independent ruler of considerable influence, yeah.
So you would not have been, I mean, did you detect any signs of nationalist agitation or communal
No, but I'll tell you something that, as you probably know, each officer commissioned from Dehradun or Sandhurst to the Indian Army used to have to do a year with a British battalion to get acclimatized, learn the language before he joined his Indian regiment. And we had, in the course of our time in India, six of them who were absolutely superb guys. One became general, one became head of Pakistan Airways, one was killed, most gallant chap of Sikh, and one was one of the leaders of the INA and was court-martialed in the Red Fort. I knew him very well. He was a nice enough chap. Now, he was the one chap I came across ever in India who was politically minded. I mean, very hotly politically minded.
A passionate man.
I wouldn't say passionate, but I mean serious. There we are.
Where was he from? Which part of India?
Prem Sagal? I don't know. I think he was UP. I think he was.
What religion was he?
Well, he was like they all were, platoon commander in those days. And he was a company commander in Malaya, surrendered, and somehow got involved in the high command of the INA.
What was he? Was he a Hindu or a Muslim or?
The whole thing. He was one of the three court-martialed, yeah.
Did you actually have any trouble in Singapore while you were on the island?
No.
Had to be sorted out.
None at all.
What were the battalion's main activities?